For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
I just got back from Brazil. We spent about 3 weeks there. We've been visiting old friends, and we've kind of watched them grow up and get married and have their kids. And it really is a wonderful thing to have relationships. And I think there's something magic about relationships. Well, there's something spiritual, actually, about relationships. You know, that people can connect, and that even when we're thousands and thousands of miles apart, when we get back together again, I had several conversations with people that felt kind of like I had just walked out the door a year and a half ago, and I walked back in the door and pick up the same conversation. And it's a beautiful thing that God has created us so that we're relational people. And I think that, you know, all of us, of course, want our children to be happy. We want them to be successful in life. And we recognize that healthy relationships, no matter how successful they are in other parts of their life, healthy relationships are really essential to them being able to be happy and productive people. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I think that we tend to romanticize relationships. Our culture tells us that when we meet the right people, it will just happen. You know, especially in romantic relationships, but even with other kinds of relationships, we often think that if we're having struggles with somebody, it's because we've met the wrong person, or we have the wrong friends, or maybe we should be in a different small group, or whatever. Or we think with our children, if we love them enough, if we love them unconditionally, if we affirm them constantly, then they'll be relationally healthy people. And I want to say that that's a myth. It's something that's simply not true. We don't develop healthy relationships by being loved unconditionally by someone, if unconditional love means a constant flow of affirmation and a constant avoidance of conflict and a constantly being told that you're so good and you're so wonderful. My generation tried that. It didn't work super well. And probably for the last 30 or 40 years, the dominant understanding in parenting has been, we just have to love them. And if we love them enough, everything will be okay. And given who human beings are, that's an illusion. There's a whole lot more to building healthy relationships than this idea of unconditional love. So that's what we're going to talk about today, is why it doesn't work and what can build healthy relationships. I ran across an article recently that I thought was super helpful. It was based on a study done by The Ohio State University and the University of Amsterdam in looking at why so many children are narcissists. But maybe before I read a little tiny bit of this, let's define it a little bit. What is a narcissist? What is narcissism? It's kind of a fun word. Any thoughts?
Selfishness.
Selfishness, okay.
Excessive
selfishness. Yeah, you got to say excessive because we're all selfish. That's just kind of the way it is. But a narcissist, what is that person like? They like what? They like an audience. Yeah, an audience is super important. They need the echo of, yes, you're good, yes, you're great, yes, you're wonderful. A narcissist is somebody who thinks that the whole world revolves around them, who thinks that they should be the one at the front of the line, and they should be the one that wins the lottery, and they should be the one that gets all the good things. A narcissist is somebody who doesn't know how to set limits on themselves around other people. And sometimes it's not, narcissism isn't necessarily something that is driven by how great I think I am. Sometimes narcissism is even driven by how bad I think I am. You know, but it still is all about me. I know a person who I do love, and I'm, you know, try to continue to build in that relationship, but it's a hard one. And everything I say, like she'll ask me, you know, how are you? And I'll say, well, you know, this or this or this. Well, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. I'm like, I'm not asking you to help me with that. I'm just saying, I'm answering your question. This is how I am or whatever. But she's unable to take in any information without processing it on the basis of how it affects her. Or what she's going to do about it. And that's a narcissistic personality. And there's a lot of that in our culture. And too much, you know, you're such a wonderful child, builds a narcissistic perspective into our children's lives. So this study by the OSU and the Amsterdam University was interesting. And I think the primary quote here is that narcissism in children is cultivated by parental over-evaluation. Parents believing that their child is more special and more entitled than others. You know, we can teach our kids, you're the one who deserves the best, and you're the one who deserves the starring role in the play, and that kind of thing. So I included this very brief article in your handout for today, so you can refer to that later if you like. What we're going to look at, though, is what is healthy unconditional love. Because the whole idea of unconditional love is not a problem. You know, there's no way that we can love our children too much, but it's just how we express that love. Many times when I talk about parenting, in the last numbers of years, I've kind of settled on using this idea of a moral compass. Because often we talk about parenting, we talk about activities, or we talk about developing gratitude, or we talk about just any number of different topics. And I find that the idea of a moral compass helps to kind of bring it all together into one concept. So if we look at the moral compass, and we look first at North, we realize that North is God as our ultimate reference point. And why that is important is because it gives our child and us a sense of identity, a place in the universe. When we explain to our children who they are in relationship to God, they understand who they are in the universe. I think it's a little bit hard for kids to grasp this idea that there are 8 billion of us on this planet. You know, and what makes them special? What makes them different? And it's that connection with God that they need to learn about. The vision of being a part of the narrative of history. And I think one of the most significant generators of hopelessness in our culture is that people think that life isn't going anywhere. And this is all there is. So when we teach our kids, you know, that no, life had a beginning. And God had a plan for us. And God created a beautiful world. And God is in the process of bringing us back to a new creation that is completely renewed. And we have a place, we have our part in that history of what God is doing. And security, a clear understanding of what grace is and how we are accepted by God. So my question right now is, today we're focusing on healthy relationships, but I want to ask the question, what does North have to do with healthy relationships? What does the existence of the way God works in our lives, what does that have to do with healthy relationships? Any thoughts? Okay, so because God designed relationships, I think it's super important to teach our children. We need to ask them the question, what does it mean to be a human being? You know, and explain to them what it means to be a human being is that we are people that were created by somebody who is love and who is connection and who is all about justice. And so these things are important to us. So it helps us then, it helps our kids to understand who they are and understand relationships better. And the way it works in relationships is, what if I do something wrong? What if I do something wrong? Will everybody be mad at me? Will everybody reject me? And I think that kids who don't understand very well their relationship with God have a harder time in their relationships with people, because often those relationships are fueled either by feeling guilty or by judging other people. I was with a mother and daughter a number of years ago, and the daughter was on a tricycle in the front yard, and a girl walked down the street on the other side of the street, and she was wearing a mini skirt and listening to bebop music or whatever, and maybe she had peers. I don't know what she had, but this was an extremely conservative family in South Brazil. And the mother, as she walked by, the mother called out to the girl, "What would Jesus think about her?" You know, and the little girl looked back at her mother and said, "Jesus would not be happy." And I just thought, oh my God, what? You know, what is she teaching her child about the evaluation of God, of other people? Like, these things even mattered anyway. But so often, I think, without it being so blatant and so big, we can sometimes teach our children that some people are more important than other people. Or that if people don't conform to what we think of as a good idea, that we need to help our children understand that Jesus doesn't like that. You know, there's a huge impact on the relationships they have with other people if they grow up thinking that it's normal to judge or to condemn or to constantly be evaluating all of the people around them. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't help our kids develop discernment. It doesn't mean that we don't help our kids to understand what is and what isn't healthy as a way to live. But I do think that we as parents, sometimes if we have that bent towards being judgmental towards other people, that it really does impact how our children develop a concept of what relationships are about. I think sometimes children learn to become fearful of their own behavior. I often hear parents even hear sometimes saying things like, "Well, I don't think Jesus would be very happy if you did that." I think, wow, we're going to put the happiness of the creator of the universe on our 3-year-old? I don't think that's really a good idea. You know, as they grow and develop, they do need to understand that their behavior has an impact, that God has an opinion, and that sometimes there are types of behavior that they can be involved in that really do grieve God. But I don't think it's an appropriate or healthy thing for us as parents to be using God's emotional state as a motivator for our kids' behavior. And what does this have to do with relationship? I really do think that the way people we feel about ourselves in terms of guilt or forgiveness or judgmentalism or acceptance of other people, that weighs very heavily then into how we relate to the people around us. So a healthy understanding of grace, I think, is one of the key foundational factors to developing healthy relationships with other people. It also helps when people, our kids will be hurt by other kids. It's just the way it is. You know, kids will say something mean, they'll bully, my child, when he was 2 years old, a kid came up behind him and hit him with a huge stick, kind of like a baseball bat, right in the back of his head, and gave him a concussion, and he had to have stitches. And things happen. You know, and how do we respond to these things, and how do we help our kids walk through them and understand what a healthy acceptance and forgiveness of other people is all about? You know, that, yeah, we can. We will get bruised and battered in the life that we're in, and that's just kind of a normal part of what it means to be a human being, and that the perfect part is later. The perfect part isn't going to happen in this life. Is that making some sense? You know, helping our kids to have healthy expectations of other people helps them to have less conflict in the relationships that they have. Let's look a little bit further east on the compass point is engagement. We're going to focus more on this a little bit later on, but I just wanted to say that, like I have already mentioned, we were created by God to connect with other people. It's an essential part of who a human being is. I don't know when they did the human genome research, if they found the gene for connecting, but it is as much an inherent part of who we are as human beings as any genetic structure. And then the idea here that all moral development, it depends on empathy. It's all about engagement. Probably, I don't remember how many years ago it was, a book came out from Brown University called The Moral Child. Has anybody read that book or seen that? It's been in the Xenos bookstore for probably 25 years, ever since I discovered it, because it has such a profound impact on my understanding of how kids grow. And I really recommend the book. And the whole basis of that research study, it's a secular book, and it was a research study about how children develop empathy and why some children don't have it. And the thesis is that all moral development is predicated on the development of empathy. That if I care for you, if I have a sense for how you're feeling, and if that's important to me, then I won't do things that hurt you. I will have healthier relationships. And sort of the keynote, I guess, example of the book was when this psychologist was called in to help evaluate and help the police work with a 13-year-old who had been beating up elderly people and stealing their money. He knew when their social security checks came in, and he'd follow them home from the bank and beat them up and steal them from them. And he was really, it was an unusually cruel and ruthless thing. He even beat up an old blind lady who was in the hospital for a while. They tried to help this kid understand. This lady was really hurt, and she's so afraid now she won't come out of her apartment anymore. And the kid was just like, he looked at the psychologist and he just laughed and said, what do I care? I'm not her. What do I care? I'm not her. You know, and I think that's something that is a little bit startling, but that's basically what the lack of empathy is all about. And so empathy is the reverse of that. I do care. I'm not her, but I understand how she feels, and I understand what her life is about. It's super important, I think, that we help our kids understand what are people for. And people, in essence, are for relationship and are made for, created for that. Here's one that we don't like to talk about, but another part of the point of the compass is south, which is suffering. Suffering is a normal part of life, and it's something that our kids are going to come into contact with from very early on. What does suffering have to do with relationships? How does that, you know, we're talking about healthy relationships today. What's the fact that life is about has suffering in it got to do with it? Any thoughts on that? Yeah. How we categorize what suffering is super important. How we define suffering matters. Because if we define suffering as something that is normal, that happens to everybody, that I'm here for you and I'm going to help walk you through it, your friends can help be here for you and walk you through it, oh, your friend is suffering, we can walk them through it, then they have a whole different kind of reaction to it than if they think that suffering is some horrible thing that happens all of a sudden out of nowhere and that they don't deserve it and they're going to react against it. And you know, oftentimes as parents, when our kids fall down or when they don't get invited to the birthday party or when something happens that is really hard on them, we forget that these things are normal. And we subtly teach our kids, oh, it's unfair. Oh, you've been really wronged. Oh, this is something really abnormal. And we kind of actually encourage our kids to make their reaction to it stronger than it needs to be. So if my child was disappointed by another child, maybe the play date was canceled, or because he decided to go to the zoo with his cousins instead, or something like that. If our children think that suffering or feeling bad is a bad thing, then they're going to think that somebody did something bad to them, and they're going to have relationship conflict as a result of that. So how we define suffering really matters. And also how we define suffering as opposed to disappointment, as opposed to, you know, I mean, suffering for us sometimes has a way too big a definition. And I think we need to bring it down into suffering is when we are really hard-pressed physically, emotionally, or spiritually in a situation that we need help to resolve. Suffering isn't just that, you know, I got milk spilled on my teddy bear, or the other kid didn't invite me to the play date and that kind of thing. So it's pretty important, I think, how we respond to suffering. So how we face suffering and disappointment may be the most important gift we give to our children. When our car breaks down on the side of the road and we've got a flat tire and this is a type of suffering and we just lose it, what are we teaching our kids? We're teaching them that suffering is abnormal, things going wrong is really, really bad, and that it throws us off. Emotionally, it throws us off relationally when bad things happen. And so if we can teach our kids that, yeah, you know, bad things happen, it's a really bummer, but it's normal, they have a stronger foundation then in themselves, so that when they experience conflict with their friend and their friend brings in some small suffering in their life, they don't feel like they have to overreact to it. Does that make some sense? You know, I think how we teach our kids to suffer is a super important thing. West is about wealth and work. We are made in the image of God, and so God has given us meaningful work. So when I talk about wealth and work, well, our children aren't going to work yet. So, but what it basically means is talking about goods and services and the management of what we have. And oftentimes our kids, we just forget to let them do the things that they're really able to do. And we help them to develop an attitude that mom's going to take care of it. Mom's going to do it. Mom will take care of me. Dad will get me what I want. And developing an entitlement kind of attitude about a lot of different kinds of things in life. Now, you might think that that doesn't really matter a whole lot when they're 3 years old, that we don't make them pick up their toys or help make their dinner or set the table or whatever. But it matters a whole lot when they're 8 years old and 10 years old and 12 years old and they're going to other people's houses for parties and they just don't help with anything because they don't have any vision for that. And it matters when they go on campouts and they sit there while everybody else pitches the tents. And in lots of subtle ways, a wrong attitude about work makes a big difference in relationships. Have you ever had a relationship with someone and you just feel like they're not pulling their weight? Is it frustrating? Yeah, it's super frustrating. And so when we talk about healthy relationships, we tend to talk about, you know, how we treat each other and how we resolve conflicts and all that. But what I'm trying to say with this moral compass idea is that the basis of relationships is that we're healthy in all of these areas. And then from that, we're able to move into individual relationships with people. And that if we have something that's out of kilter in the area of work and entitlement, or in the area of suffering, and I think that everything you say to me that makes me feel bad is some big suffering, you know, or I don't really understand that God completely and fully accepts me even when I do something wrong, then I'm going to have conflict in relationships. I think that also with this whole thing about work is that we need to realize that children are people too. Sometimes we think of children as some kind of separate species or category of beings, but they're people too. And they need to know that they have meaningful work and meaningful contributions. I'm really happy when particularly my oldest grandson, when he's at my house and they've made a mess everywhere, I tell him, like, okay, it's time to pick up, and I want to make sure that when I walk back into the room, it looks like you've never been here. And he takes a huge amount of pride in making sure that the room looks like they were never there, which my kids didn't do. But, you know, it must be a grandchild magic kind of thing. But anyway, they need to know that they can make provision for themselves and other people, and that they have a contribution. Let's get back to actually building healthy relationships as our compass point for today. And I want to say that the Bible, above every other thing, is profoundly, it's a relational book. The Bible is about relationships in so many ways. It talks about bear with one another, turn the other cheek, be devoted to one another. So far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Stop passing judgment on one another. You know, I think one of the most encouraging insights that I've had in the last few years, for some reason, I've always known it, but it really came to me full force a few years ago. I was reading through something, and I realized that my job isn't to judge people. That Jesus himself said, I did not come here to judge. And I think, wow, if he didn't feel a need to judge people, then so much less do I need to feel that. And I'm so relieved that that's not our job. I'm so relieved that our job is to learn how to successfully engage and interact with people and build them up. So we can pass that on to our kids too about that. So today, how can my child develop healthy relationships? I want to just say that all of the compass points come together. Like I've been trying to say, relationships are dependent on an integrated life. And so if our kid is having struggles and difficulties in relationships, let's not get blindsided and focus only on that particular conflict that he has. Let's keep remembering that he also needs to learn to work and to pull his share, that he also needs to learn to understand what suffering is all about and what he also needs to learn about grace and forgiveness. And there's a whole wide range of things that our children need to learn about. So the compass points relate to the idea of core needs. And the problem that we have in relationships often is that we have an empty core. What would it mean, perhaps, to have this idea of an empty core? What is an empty core based on this idea of compass points? It would be the idea that somewhere from deep inside of them, something's missing, and they sense that something's missing. Here's an example of this type of thing. I used to work in the Amazon region with a lot of very poorly educated, mostly second, third grade educated young adults who had almost zero prospects for jobs in life and felt like they were pretty incompetent and useless kind of people. But we needed a lot of volunteers to do vaccination campaigns in villages. And so about every 3 months I'd gather together, I don't know, a dozen or so of these guys who were hanging out in the church and in the community and teach them how to give injections to children and how to do all the paperwork involved in the vaccinations and things like that. And it was fascinating to me to see the way they responded to that. You know, suddenly, it's the work part. It's the West on the compass point. Suddenly, they had something that they could do. Suddenly, they had something to contribute. Suddenly, they were doing something that mattered in the lives of people around them. And you could just see how an empty core that drove a lot of despondence and drove a lot of like conflict in relationships, something in that empty core was satisfied. And they then began to open up in other areas and develop healthier relationships in other areas. Is this making sense? You know, that our ability to relate to other people is dependent on how we feel about ourselves and how we perceive the world around us, as much as it is on any kind of techniques about building close relationships. So the problem of the empty core is that in one of those compass points somewhere, there's a place that's missing. There's a piece that's missing about who we are as people. Emotional bolstering cannot compensate for an empty core. And oftentimes if our children are suffering, what we want to do is we say, oh, you're okay, it's all right, you know, I love you. And instead of saying, you're okay, it's all right, I love you, I think it's really helpful for us to look and see, where is the piece of the empty core in my child's life? And even when they're 3 years old, you're not necessarily going to see it. But as they get older, we'll see more and more clearly. If we look at the compass points carefully, and if we pray, Lord, show me where my child has an emptiness. Show me where there's a gap in his healthy understanding of how people work and how the world works. Show me that. And then as we address those issues, so often the relational conflicts and difficulties that they have will start getting worked out. So in our emptiness, we tend to have insecurity. We feel needy. And we're hungry for affirmation. If we're hungry for affirmation, our child will typically take one of two courses. Either our child will become a taker, give me, give me, give me, I'm anxious, I don't feel useful, I don't feel important, I don't feel loved, I need you to give me something. And the child is trying to take something into themselves that is going to make them feel better. You know, and this is the demanding child, the child who thinks that he's entitled to everything. Or oftentimes we have the child who's just giving, constantly giving, giving, giving. Well, you know, nobody likes me. I don't feel good. I feel like I don't feel connected with people. So I'm going to keep giving and then people will like me. Is this ringing any bells? Does this sound at all realistic to you guys? So typically, when people grow up as adults, they tend to be, if they're insecure, they tend to be either a kind of a taker kind of a person or a giver kind of a person. And I really would like to recommend to you this book called Boundaries for Children. Has anybody ever read any of the Boundaries books? Yeah, they're super, super useful. Boundaries isn't about building fences to keep people out, but boundaries is about saying, I am me, and these are things that are my responsibilities, and you are you, and these are the things that are your responsibilities. And I can help you with your responsibilities if you like, but I'm not responsible for your responsibilities. And it helps people to not become enmeshed in taking responsibility for other people. And I think that even for children, it's helpful, because sometimes little kids even will say, well, my friend so-and-so feels bad, I have to do this, I have to do that. And they take on responsibility. They take on emotional responsibility for the needs of the people around them. And sometimes that's really hard on them. And it's something we need to help them work through as they grow. So I really recommend that book, Boundaries for Children. There's also a book, Boundaries for Marriage. I just read that recently. In fact, my husband and I are currently reading it. I had no idea. It's a really fascinating book. I want to recommend that too. One of the things also that I think divides kids and makes their relationships difficult is what I call an intuitive violation of conscience. Okay, that sounds kind of crazy, but what does that mean? I think that kids have an internal register for what's the right kind of behavior and what's not the right kind of behavior. And if we allow them to violate their own conscience on a regular basis, it generates anxiety in them. It generates oftentimes withdrawal from other people or even hostility. I once knew a child who, let's say he was maybe 4 years old, and he was like always demanding things. And his parents were very much, you know, give. It just happened to be a characteristic of that family. And even to the point where, you know, the child would just go bananas if they had to leave playgroup. And his pregnant mother would pick him up, and she'd kick her in the belly, you know, and the father would peel him off of the mother and say, it's okay, we'll get ice cream, it's okay, we have to go, but we'll go get ice cream. You know, that kind of thing where, you know, the child's behavior was really, really out of line. But the parent's response to that was constantly to appease, to try and make it better. I mean, even kicking a pregnant mother in the belly was like, you're just upset. And I had to, you know, as I watched this decades back, as I've watched this particular child develop, you know, I've just realized how much there has to have been a huge amount of inner conflict going on about, I know this isn't the right way to be, but this is, you know, but this is how I feel like being, and nobody's helping me learn to be anything else. And I don't want to say that the fact that this person is bipolar today has anything to do with the fact that he was allowed to, you know, kick his mother when he was 3. But I do believe that we don't develop emotional stability in a context where we know we're doing things that are wrong, and we keep doing it anyway. You know, and kids don't have that inner control. They'll know they're doing something wrong. They'll feel bad about it inside in ways that they can't even articulate. But there's something in them that's going to feel bad, and they keep doing it anyway. And when we teach them to violate their own conscience, when we allow or we even facilitate them violating their own conscience, I think that that's a lot of what happens when we see kids being hostile and bullying and having a lot of the problems that we see in relationships in schools today. What does it mean? Children understand that when they're habitually selfish or mean, they understand it when they are habitually selfish, when they're habitually mean. They get it. Even though they would deny it, even though they would justify it if you tried to talk to them about it, it still produces an inner anxiety. Because of the way God created us to be, because of the importance of relationships, even if we don't teach our children that it's wrong when they hurt other people, they know that somehow inside, and it causes them to have a lot of anxiety. I think it does create anxiety in some kids, withdrawal or hostility, bullying, and that kind of thing. So that's just a thought about another thing about building healthy relationships is teaching our kids to treat other people in really respectful and positive ways so that, yeah, the relationship progresses, but so that they're also not damaging their own conscience. Healthy things that we can cultivate when we're working with our children. Like I said, I think that empathy is probably one of the most important things, because when I really care about you and who you are and I know you as a person, I don't want to hurt you. I've often said that the most important sex education that we can give to our children is not about anatomy and biology, and it's not even about moral principles and ethical standards. The most important sex education we can give to our children is to teach them a deep sense of empathy. a deep sense of the value of the people that they're interacting with. So that when I'm in a relationship with you, I don't want to do anything that could harm you. I don't want to do anything that could bring bad results into your life. I care for you so much that I'm not going to try to satisfy myself at your expense. And when kids have that internalized understanding of empathy, then they're way more able to experience delayed gratification, to behave appropriately in a relationship. I also wanted to just mention, I included also in your handout this life hack. Life hack is the new thing. This is called a trick to teach kids compassion. And I won't read the whole thing right now, but I think it's a pretty fascinating little story about someone who wants their children to understand that people have complicated lives and things are sometimes people are experiencing things that are more difficult than they think, and they shouldn't just react to a person's behavior. I think the classic story about this kind of is the story of a man who got on a subway, and another man got on with two little kids. And the two little kids were running up and down and bothering people and jumping up and down. And the man was completely ignoring them and in his own life. And the other one was sitting there judging him and like, what's wrong with you? And why aren't you taking care of your kids? And, you know, of course, at the end of the story, finally he goes and confronts the father for the bad behavior of his kids and finds that the father is grieving because his wife just died. You know, and he's like, oh, what am I going to do with these kids? So the idea of this story is that oftentimes people are doing things that we think they shouldn't be doing or we don't understand. And we have to get to know them in order for their story to make sense. And we don't need to be judging them based on just what we see, but trying to move towards them. And so this lady has an interesting habit where she's with her children and she'll do people watching. You could go to the airport or you could go to the park or you could sit in the grocery store and watch people walk by. And so there's a guy walking down the street with tons of tattoos, you know, or whatever, and say, hey, what's this? What do you think that guy is about? And the kid makes up a story then. Oh, he owns a tattoo parlor, and he's on his way on the other side of the street because he needs to get more ink. And just in the process of making up all these stories about people, it basically teaches them to think about the fact that the people that they see on the street, the people that they run into, have stories that are deeper than what we can see. And it helps them to create a sense of empathy. And so when they immediately run into somebody and they're doing something that we don't like, or they're doing something that doesn't make any sense to us, we don't automatically assume that they're doing this to irritate us, or they're doing this because they don't want to control their children, or for whatever reason. But they already have this idea, this sort of habit of thinking, well, I wonder what that person is about. And so that love, that empathy helps them as they relate to the people around them. All right. It's fun to explore the internet and look for interesting parenting things. I get a feed from the New York Times every day, and so there's these little things out. We have to use an incredible amount of discernment because there's some really crazy ideas out there. But sometimes you'll see things that are really well researched and really well put together, like this one about teaching kids compassion, that are super helpful. Another thing that we want to cultivate in our kids is gratitude. And gratitude, I think, is probably... Okay, one of the maybe most important things we can teach our kids, because our human tendency is to be upset with how today is going, is to feel like I don't have enough today. And yet, when we can have a heart that's deeply embedded in gratitude, we look at our lives in such a completely different way. There's another article that I also attached called How Not to Raise a Narcissist in 9 Easy Steps. And an awful lot of this is about gratitude. It's about living realistically in the world around us. And so, again, I'm not going to read this all to us today, but a couple of key things here are being able to say no to our kids. You know, it's a simple thing. But a narcissist can't hear the word no. And so it's important that our kids hear that when they're young. It says teaching them basic manners. This person says, a lack of manners is the ultimate form of narcissism. Whether it's someone who is rude to waiters, has bad table manners, or can't be bothered to dress for the occasion, lack of manners is signaling to the world that you have no need to conform to any silly social codes or basic ideas of decency. And what counts is your comfort. And this goes on in many a number of different ways to talk about what narcissism is. The whole gratitude thing is about being in our hearts happy to see that there are other people in our lives. It's being able to recognize that life would be really cold. Life would be so lonely and difficult if we didn't have these relationships. And so we're grateful that they're there. And if they are conflictual, if there are difficulties in those relationships, we're looking for ways to solve them as opposed to looking for ways to withdraw from them. Is this making some sense? When we're grateful for the people around us, we're automatically more predisposed to try to work things out. We're automatically more willing to engage with them. So gratitude, as opposed to entitlement. And resilience. Oftentimes as parents, we want to focus on them being happy. And I think we all understand that happiness is not a life goal. If happiness is a life goal, we're never going to achieve it. Happiness is a byproduct of having healthy relationships. And so one of the things about resilience I think that is important is the idea of understanding hurt versus harm. A lot of times our kids will come home from preschool or school or whatever, and they will be hurt by something that another child has said. You know, we see that, you know, or they didn't get invited or whatever. This is hurt, and the emotion is real. But they're not essentially being harmed by this. They're not going to remember that kid by the time they're in the eighth grade, much less when they're an adult. They're not, their life is not being harmed by the thing that was said to them. They're just hurt in that moment. And I think it's super important to help our kids understand that, to help them see, yeah, this is painful. You know, I'm really sorry that your feelings are hurt. I can understand. I would feel that way too. But it's not harming you. It's not something that's going to harm you for the long haul. One of my grandchildren had colic. And so, you know, you're sitting here with babies. You know how just frazzling and upsetting it is to hear a baby crying, you know, all afternoon or all evening or all into the night. And you just feel like, you know, this child is dying and you've got to do something. You know, and it produces in us a huge amount of anxiety and fear. And I remember talking to my daughter at one point, just saying, you know what? This colic is caused by expanding gases in the colon. And as the colon is being stretched, those gases cause the nerve endings to send out signals of pain. But nothing is being harmed. As soon as that gas is gone and those tissues, you know, reconstrict to where they're supposed to be, it will be as though nothing ever happened. And so even though it's frazzling and even though it's difficult and even though it's frustrating to hear your child crying, realize that they're not actually being harmed, that this is just a kind of temporary thing. Does that make some sense? And on an emotional and conflictual and relational level, it's the same thing. So many times we are hurt and there is pain and it is something we need to respond to, but we're not being harmed, either us in our relationships or our children in their relationships. And teaching them the difference between hurt and harm is a real helpful way to help them understand that, yeah, this relationship is difficult for me right now, but I can calm down enough by realizing I'm not being harmed. I can calm down enough to then sit down and look for ways that I can mend that relationship or that I can move towards that person in the relationship. So what are some healthy unconditional love ideas? I read this book many, many years ago, How to Really Love Your Child. Has anybody ever heard of that book? I had it on my bookshelf. When I became a parent, I came from a very dysfunctional home with a lot of with mental illness and alcoholism, and I had no idea how to be a parent. In fact, I wasn't going to have children when I first got married. I just thought there's no way. And then after I'd been married for a few years, I thought, well, you know, this has worked out okay. I guess maybe God is adequate to help me to learn how to be a parent also. But I really had no idea what it meant to be a warm and nurturing person and create a safe environment for children. And so I read about 25 books on parenting the first year I started thinking about being a parent. And what one of them that stayed on my bookshelf for a long time that I refused to read was How to Really Love Your Child. And I thought, what a presumptuous title, How to Really Love Your Child. That just sounds so ridiculous. But for some reason, I finally got over my arrogant approach to that book, and I read it, and I was shocked. I was shocked because I literally would sit by my child's crib and cry for my first child because I was like, I love you. I feel so much love for you, but I don't know how to make you know that I love you. You know, and I just wasn't brought up with feelings of being loved. And this book answered all of my questions. I was so shocked. It's so easy to help a child feel loved. Eye contact? Oh, yeah. Look at them when you talk to them, you know, and really let them know that you're with them. Focused attention instead of like, you know, they want to talk to you and you're doing the dishes and you're kind of like, yeah, 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 yeah. Taking that time to sit down and really have interaction with them and touching them. picking them up, holding them, moving them back and forth like this lady is here with her baby. Picking up, and the way we pick up our children, the way we hold them, the way we touch them, tells them, oh, I'm not afraid of you. Oh, I'm not put off by you. Oh, you don't cause me anxiety. I'm really here with you. And so that appropriate kind of touch. And I thought, wow, what a beacon of hope for me. I don't know how to do all the big things of life with my children right now, but I know how to do that. You know, and it really was super helpful to me as a young parent to learn to love my children that way. Anybody else struggle with, will my child know that I love them? I did. Healthy, unconditional love is really being engaged and teaching our kids how to be engaged when people come over. Healthy, unconditional love doesn't get on our smartphone, you know, and do all the texting, all that kind of stuff while we're talking to our kids. You know, it's a hard thing, but in America today, it's estimated that adults spend 4 to 6 hours a day of screen time, you know, between TV and computer and phone and all that kind of thing. And we've all heard these numbers and these ideas, and it's not new. But wow, what an incredible impact it's having on who we are as human beings. And I've been hearing recently that the new generation from 2010, I forget what they're calling them at this moment, but that they don't view technology as something that they pick up and use as a tool. They view it as something that's a part of who they are. And I find that to be profoundly disturbing. I'm old enough to feel like a computer is my tool that I buy at the store. And if I don't want to use it, I can put it away or I can throw it out if I want to. You know, but these digital natives just have so much more of a sense that that their phones and their devices are a part of who they are. And so one of the things that really I think has a lot to do with teaching healthy, unconditional love is our ability to put those things aside and not be doing a lot of screen time in our children's presence. Now, of course, there are going to be times. A lot of us work from home, which is a great new innovation. A lot of us have responsibilities and things. But to be able to say to our child, I need to respond to these things right now. I'm going to take a half an hour and respond to what I need to do for my work. It's a whole lot different than just the kind of distracted, you know, 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off, 5 minutes on, 5 minutes off. I'm sure that, you know, we all struggle with that and with the idea that oftentimes our kids are running around the room and we're on our phone, you know. And some of that's okay. We have to do that. But I think we can really think about it in terms of their understanding of what it means to be engaged. Because if their idea of what it means to be engaged is half brain on, half brain off, then they're not going to learn to understand that really strong relational tie that you can have with a person when you actually sit in front of them and have eye contact with them and drink a cup of coffee and actually have conversations with them for half an hour or an hour or a couple hours at a time. One of the articles I read recently, because I'm just always curious about these things, just talked about the fact that so many young people that are in high school and college, they don't know how to have a conversation. And that's a gift we've got to give our kids, how to have a conversation, how to actually talk to them about things. And the only way we can do that is if we're engaged and off of our devices. And then another way, I'm just kind of summing up here now, that's important for healthy, unconditional love is to support our child's conscience. They do have a conscience, every single one of them. And it's a deeply rooted part of who they are as human beings. So we need to support that conscience, you know, and when they know they've done something wrong, we need to agree with them and not just say, oh, it's okay, it's okay, it's okay. Say, yeah, that was really not a good idea. I remember one time my son pushed my daughter down on the sidewalk and kind of mushed up her face and he wanted to keep on playing. I was like, no. No, we're going to go inside and get some ice, and you're going to sit here by my side until she stops screaming, you know, and you can help me, you know, you go get the ice while I sit here and that kind of thing. And being involved in the reparation of the things that they do, you know, being involved in matters of conscience. Because sometimes we don't want the offending child to feel bad about who they are. You know, we think, oh, we don't want him to feel guilty. Really? What's wrong with feeling guilty? Feeling shame, that really does destroy ourselves when I feel like I'm not a worthy enough person to belong to this family. That's really destructive. But feeling guilty, oh, I did X wrong, I hurt somebody, I need to ask for forgiveness, that's a healthy thing. That's a healthy thing that God has put in us. And this is one of the ways we can help support our child's conscience, is to agree with them when they feel like they did something wrong and say, yeah, you did. You know, but let's ask, you know, let's just tell your sister that you're really sorry. And then sit here, because you're not going to go playing while a child that you hurt is still sitting here crying. And then when she's done crying and you guys are good together, then you can both go back out and play. Does that idea make sense? That we support our child's conscience. And we do that through lifelong mentoring. We do that, you know, from a very, very early age, all throughout their lives. Mentoring just means basically coming alongside them and helping them understand how life works. And these are some really significant ways about how life works. So that's really basically what I had to say today, that healthy relationships begin with a realistic and grateful perspective on life. And we didn't talk a lot today about talking techniques and conflict resolution techniques, but what I wanted to do today is just to give us a bigger picture of the fact that it is an integrated life where we understand who we are before God. We understand the deep need on the East, the engagement that we have with other people, can have with other people. When on South suffering, we understand that the world is a difficult place, and we walk with each other through that suffering, and that suffering is normal, even when it's caused by other people. And West, the wealth aspect. We teach our kids to be a contributing member to society and a contributing member to relationships. And all of that put together, all of those integrated parts of life will help our kids to have healthy relationships because they know where they're coming from. So I'll close with this quote from Cicero, that gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all others. That gratitude is really the basis on which we relate to other people. For me, having grown up in a home where I felt a lot of despair, the thing that helped me to understand all of this was coming to understand that God is the one who made that moral compass, and that God is the one who created me and created the needs that I have. And when I came into a relationship with Jesus, it was shocking to me how, having resolved that question of who am I and do I belong in the universe and am I approved by God, it was shocking to me how that changed my relationships with the people around me. And I think we'll see this with our kids as they grow, when we can root them in the solidity of understanding that they are beloved of God and that they are acceptable as human beings before their God. It gives them a strength then to have relationships and to resolve the conflicts of relationships. So I think we have some time to have questions or comments, if anybody has any. Any thoughts? Yeah.
Hello. Back in the notes you put under or intuitive violation of conscience creates anxiety, withdrawal, and hostility. You gave an example, but it's still a little fuzzy for me, so I'm asking for maybe another example of what you meant, just to clarify.
Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is that if I'm allowed to do things that I know are wrong, that's going to generate anxiety in me. And if a child is habitually allowed to be overly aggressive or overly demanding or whatever, then when they come to somebody else's house and those habits are not reinforced, the anxiety of that will often cause them to react in ways that are really unhealthy in that environment as well. We're setting up kids, when kids know that they've been doing things that are wrong, it just creates an anxiety in them. And sometimes they just are really hostile. Like, for instance, this kid who was kicking his mother, I was like, really? But he did that all the time, and he did that oftentimes with other kids, too. It's like it builds up a sense of I am a hostile person, and that's not the identity that we want our kids to have. You know, so in a sense, they can actually come to identify with the behavior that they're having, this wrong behavior. And they know it's wrong behavior, but that's how they start seeing themselves being. Does that make sense? Okay.
In the fall, my daughter's kindergarten teacher said, among other things, she can be bossy with her peers sometime. And I was like, man, I don't want that. How can we help that? And Mrs. Tobin, the kindergarten teacher, was like, what about just praying for classmates? I was like, oh, that's such a great idea, because I don't want to sit Zoe down and be like, you know, got a bad report, I heard. You know, that's not good. We don't want to do it. And it's such a cool kind of subversive way to just build that sense of empathy. Like, I actually care about what God's doing in these people's lives.
Yep, that's really, really good. That's exactly this whole idea of of empathy. When we moved to South Brazil, we'd been in the Amazon for a long time, then we moved to South Brazil. My daughter was 13, and it was a really tough time to move to a city where she didn't know anybody. And she'd been going to an international school before in English, and even though she spoke fluent Portuguese, she'd never had to read and write in Portuguese before. So she went to a high school. She went from a little international school with 30 kids to a high school of 1,500 kids in a language that she wasn't used to reading and writing in. And those kids were super hostile. They were like, oh, there's this new girl here, you know, and who is she? And she's an American. Oh, that must, I mean, she must think she's something special. So they really went out of their way to make sure that she understood that she was not something special. To the point where one of the girls at one point told her one day, they were on a balcony at the school, I hope you fall off this balcony, and I hope that you die and your brains splatter all over the street. You know, she'd come home crying. This happened all the time. They said really incredible, cruel things to her. And I remember sitting down with her and thinking, you know, Laura, I went to the school. I mean, the only time in my entire life, I'm not an interventionist, the only time I ever, ever went to a school to say, hey, what's up with this, was this situation. And they were like, oh, well, we can't do anything because blah, 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 whatever. So, you know, I said to her, you know, why would a girl do that? Why would she act like she hates you so much? She doesn't even know you. She doesn't hate you. She must be really, really insecure. You know, I mean, she's been with her this group of friends ever since they were in kindergarten. And now you're the new girl coming in eighth grade. And she must feel really threatened by you. Maybe she thinks that if everybody likes you, they won't like her anymore. So we started praying for this girl. And I said, you know, I know it's really hard. I know you can't hardly imagine what this is going to be like. But wouldn't it be amazing if by the time, you know, if over the years, this girl actually became your friend? And I think it's really a cool thing. 20 years later, the only girl that my daughter is still in contact with is this girl. Yeah, it's just a beautiful thing. It's all about, you know, when other people are doing something that hurts us, to think about who are they, you know. And like you say, even for our own child, instead of saying, oh, you're just so bossy, you know, I mean, it's okay to say to them, you know what, we all have different personalities. And you know what, my personality is such that my tendency is to be bossy too. But I find that if I really care about the people and I pray for them, I'm able to kind of pull back on that a little bit. Yeah. Anything else? Other thoughts? Well, I guess we're done. So have a good morning, and it's good to see you all.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.